Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about some of the experiences of soldiers who were wounded in the fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, and their experiences after coming home, and the difficulties that they have faced in getting care, and often how inadequate that care is. Something like 300,000 veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan have filed disability claims with the federal government. More than that, 350,000 have sought medical care at VA hospitals, many of them waiting months for help. According to the RAND Corporation, only half of returning veterans are getting the care that they need. Our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Aaron Glantz. He's an independent journalist. His work has appeared many places, The Nation, The Progressive, San Francisco Chronicle, Democracy Now. He spent time talking with a number of veterans about their experiences and have put them together in a book that has just recently been published. The title of his book is The War Comes Home, America's Battle Against... The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. That is the subtitle. University of California Press is the publisher on this book. And it's out now, and it has a lot of disturbing things in it, which we'll talk about in this part of the show. The questions and comments from people who are listening, they certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think probably some people will know Aaron Glantz from his writing about Iraq. He's the author of the book How America Lost Iraq, co-author of The Winter Soldier, Iraq and Afghanistan. He's currently a Rosin Carter Fellow for Mental Health Journalism at the Carter Center, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. Aaron Glantz, hello.
It's good to be with you.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. There are really significant differences in the experiences that soldiers have had in Iraq and Afghanistan, things that make fighting there different from other wars that we've fought. And some of those things, we'll talk about them, and they're really important. I think, though, overall, I wanted to start out with a question. If you look at the numbers of injured, and the numbers are staggeringly large, when we're talking about hundreds of thousands mm-hmm. of people, and in fact, maybe even more whose injuries might manifest later that we don't even know about. Now, that seems to be an enormous number. If you compare that to injuries suffered, say, for example, in Vietnam or in World War II, how do they compare?
What we are looking at with this war is a record number of wounded coming home. And the reason for that is that people, because of advances in medical technology, because of the advances in military technology, the better body armor that people have now than during the Vietnam or World War II era, people who are wounded in war are thankfully much more likely to survive. Mm-hmm. And, for example, in this war, we have 15 people who are wounded for every one who is killed. This is wonderful because these people would have perished. I mean, we have 57,000 names on the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C., and after 6 years of war in Iraq and 8 years of war in Afghanistan, we have about 5,000 dead in these two wars. But just because we don't have as many flag-draped coffins coming home does not mean that people are not getting hurt. They're surviving. And you gave some of the statistics. They've even grown since those numbers came in. We now have over 400,000 veterans who have filed disability claims with the VA, and we have over 400,000 veterans who are using VA services. And we have, as you mentioned, an estimate by the RAND Corporation of 300,000 with post-traumatic stress disorder or major depression, and another 300,000 with traumatic brain injuries. And these are people who are surviving. Many of them, when they're walking down the street, you can't even tell that they have one of these wounds because although there are 1,000 amputees, more than 1,000 from this war, the people who have these traumatic brain injuries, multiple concussions sustained in roadside bomb incidents and other attacks, they look just the same as you and me. But they have short-term memory loss. They may have long-term memory loss. They may have lost the connection between their brain or part of their body. They may have literally lost part of their brain permanently in an incident. And these are real wounds that people are coming home to their communities with.
Yeah. And that's really, that again is one of the stunning differences. And it goes back to your point about the fact that technology, military technology, means that we can provide soldiers with better protection. But that as a result, the kinds of wounds that we're seeing, the kinds of injuries that we're seeing are different. And as I'm sure people have heard, we've talked about it, I'm sure it's been widely discussed, that the thing that you mentioned, traumatic brain injury, has become, some people said it's become the signature injury, the signature wound of this fight, and that significant numbers of soldiers have experienced this and may be having symptoms. There's some question about, do we really know how many, and are there people who perhaps aren't having symptoms today, or maybe their symptoms aren't really bad? They're living with them where things could get worse. And in fact, I think one of the things that you mention in the book is that there are some people who believe that when soldiers come home, they should be screened for this, and not just once, but periodically, perhaps throughout the rest of their lives, they should be screened.
One of the big problems we have with this war and the way it's been waged is that people are being deployed over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And the military is so strapped for soldiers to fight in these wars. And we just heard yesterday that Barack Obama wants to send 17,000 more troops to Afghanistan, which is only going to increase the strain on our military. And what this means is that the military is under pressure to not look to see if the people who have been deployed have PTSD or have traumatic brain injury, because if they find that a soldier is non-deployable, it's only going to make their job more difficult. And so one of the things I document in the book is how, at least under President Bush, our military leaders were literally deploying hundreds of thousands of soldiers who had suffered these injuries for multiple tours. And in Vietnam, by contrast, I mean, the Vietnam War was terrible for those who fought in it, but the vast majority of Vietnam veterans only served one tour in Vietnam because we had a draft. And so when you went over to Vietnam 1 year to the day that you set foot in the country, you were back on American soil.
And that's something, again, I'm not sure that enough attention has been given to that. That is the effects, both physiological and psychological, of repeated deployments, of the kind of stresses and strains that soldiers are under every day. Just in fact, one example just was pointed out to me. There was an article in just recently in the Washington Post about how much weight soldiers carry on their bodies. That is, what's the weight of all the equipment that they carry, and how much heavier it is than what is recommended, and how we're starting to see soldiers that have significant orthopedic joint problems simply as a result of, for several days, carrying around stuff that weighs well over 100 pounds, which is much over the what is recommended. Now that may, next to PTSD and traumatic brain injury, that might seem like a small thing, but it just seems that it is yet one more example of the real stress and strain that's put on soldiers by the experience and by these long deployments.
Oh, and your point about these back injuries, the shoulder injuries that many of our veterans sustain simply because they're carrying so much equipment, or because maybe they were in an auto accident while they were deployed, mm-hmm. or maybe they injured their shoulder jumping out of an airplane in training. You know, what I would call just kind of normal physical injuries that can happen under the regular irregular strain that our human body is not used to. Many, many veterans are coming home with one of those injuries and then also with post-traumatic stress disorder and or traumatic brain injury. So, for example, just yesterday, and I talk about him in my book, James Eggemeyer of Stuart, Florida, he came back from Iraq with post-traumatic stress disorder. When he was in Iraq, he drove convoys, and one of his jobs was, if they were dead from a convoy accident, he had to load them into Black Hawk helicopters before they were, taken away to be buried properly somewhere else away from the fighting. And you don't come back the same after that. He had a really bad case of PTSD. But then in addition to that, he had a really bad back injury and shoulder injury from training, and he had multiple concussions while he was over in Iraq from the auto accidents and explosions that he sustained. So he came back with all of these injuries layered upon each other. And, you know, in the military, you want to be tough. You want to be strong. When he came back from his tour in Iraq, he wanted to be good to go. And so he got a job at a car wash, making $8 an hour shortly after returning home from Iraq, because it's not like you get a golden ticket after you get out of the military. And he couldn't hold that job with his disabilities. He filed a disability claim with the federal government. And while he was waiting on the VA for 8 months, he lost his house. He lost contact with his son. He started living out of his truck. He was popping pain medication because he couldn't gain access to our VA system. And he crashed his truck because he was so doped up on the pain meds. And if it hadn't been for charity, people in his community buying him a new used truck, he would have been literally living on the street in Florida less than a year after coming home from Iraq. And the only reason that he was in this situation was because the government was refusing to recognize his war wounds. And the good news is that after I wrote a story about him, Senator Nelson of Florida got involved. He called the VA, and he personally inquired about this gentleman, James Eggemeyer. And the VA intervened, you know, from Washington and granted his disability check. You know, but most of our veterans don't have a reporter and a senator to help them out. And so the waiting list for people trying to get into that VA system, people filing a disability claim and having not heard back, is now 600,000 names long. And the waits are so long that in 6 months leading up to March 31st of last year, 1,500 veterans died just waiting to learn if they were going to get a disability check.
That's really another one of the statistics that's stunning and disturbing, that we should have hundreds of thousands of people waiting who have filed disability claims, just waiting. One of the things that, as you've said, and you write in the book, on the average, they have to wait almost 6 months to hear a claim. And then
that's in a best-case scenario.
Yeah.
If you have no disagreement at all with the VA, if you have a disagreement with them and you appeal, then it goes on for an average of 4.5 years.
So what's the problem here? Why does it take so long just for a claim, initially, for a claim just to be heard?
Well, it's the way our system is set up. This is why I called the book The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. You know, I started out wanting to write a book, and I was just called The War Comes Home because you know, I had been in Iraq myself, as you mentioned. I went through the process of coming home from the war. I know how difficult it is, from my own personal experience, to reconnect with your family and friends after you've, you know, seen dead people in the street. And I wanted to, or even killed somebody if you're one of our soldiers or seen your best friends be killed. And I wanted to write a book for the family members of those who had served, who were wondering what happened to their brother or sister or son or daughter, and also for the Vietnam veterans and Korean War veterans, the Gulf War veterans out there who are interested in how their experience compares to this younger generation of veterans. But the more stories I heard and the more investigating I did, I realized that our whole system of caring for our veterans has been set up to be hostile. And so that's why I called the book The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, because we make our veterans battle for each and every benefit that we promise them when they sign up.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Aaron Glantz. He is an independent journalist. His work has appeared in many places, including The Nation, The Progressive, San Francisco Chronicle, Democracy Now! He is the author of the book The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. It's published by the University of California Press. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We'd be happy to have questions, comments from listeners. We have a couple who are ready to go, starting with Belgium, Illinois, not far from us. Line number four, our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, sir. I was wondering, sir, if in your background for your book, did you check into the history of the VA? Now, when I say this, I want to point out that here in this community, over here in Danville, East Central Illinois, we had a very large soldiers' home. It was first built back after the Civil War, and it took care of the Civil War veterans. Then it took care of the First World War veterans, and then Second World War veterans, and Korea, some Vietnam, and by then it was phased out quite a bit, and now it's a much, much smaller place. It's Jews Virginia College. Many of the buildings have been torn down. When I first got out of the service back in the late 60s and went to the junior college for a summer, we saw the vets there, and their treatment was humane but not very. They would take them, put them out in the yard, and let them mow, and they would all go in different directions. I worked as a as a job there, you know, taking care of things, and you would see the old tubs to where they restrained them, the tables where they had lobotomies, and all kinds of horrible, horrible things. So this, the treatment of American vets, it's been an ongoing problem for
absolutely
a long time.
Absolutely, and you know, I have a very systematic documentation in the book of how George Bush betrayed this generation of returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. But it's not unique to George Bush, and it's not unique to this war. And I talk about how, you know, when our Vietnam veterans came home, the government denied for 26 years that Agent Orange was a cause of cancer. And they denied for 17 years until just in November that Gulf War syndrome, that our Gulf War veterans were chemically poisoned during the Gulf War by a variety of things, oil fires, PEP pills, depleted uranium. They've just now admitted that our Gulf War veterans, that one in three of them is sick. And that's because in our system, we put the burden of proof on the veteran's shoulder. Instead of saying, you served in a war, if you say you're wounded, we're going to take care of you. And this is entirely different than the way most of our government is set up. If you look at the IRS. Most people don't like the IRS. But right now, if you file your tax return, right now you're getting your W-2, your 1099, you're getting ready your taxes. When you file it, if you tell the IRS that they owe you a refund, they just send it to you. And then later on they audit you to make sure you're telling the truth. But with our VA, they don't give you a dime. They don't let you in the door to get medical treatment until some bureaucrat is convinced that you actually deserve it. And the standard of proof is very high.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller, line number one. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I wonder if you could touch on a couple points. When did this nastiness begin? My impression is, I don't know this for a fact, but my grandfathers were both veterans of the First World War, and both of them actually died in VA hospitals of natural causes. One of them almost 95 years old. My impression is of the Second World War vets that my father's generation were, is they didn't have big problems with the VA. So when did this cheapness occur and so forth? And now that the criminal regime is gone and the Obama administration is, what are you seeing? Bits of light, any signs of advancement that the Obama administration is actually going to reverse any of this in a substantial way?
Thank you so much for your question and comment. These issues are longstanding, and I think if you look at history, you'll see that World War II was the exception rather than the rule. After World War II, we did do a very good job of taking care of our veterans. But if you look at history, it's not just Vietnam, it's not just Iraq where the veterans have been kicked to the curb. It's after the Gulf War, which was another popular war. It's after Korea. And it was also after World War One. I mean, remember, in World War One, our veterans were promised a bonus when they got home. And they didn't receive it. And after the stock market crash in 1929, they started to organize to demand that they actually be paid that bonus because many of them were hungry. And they marched on Washington, and they occupied the Capitol Mall. And President Hoover actually called out the U.S. Army to attack them. And General MacArthur and General Patton led a charge and drove with violence and horses and guns these wounded veterans who had been promised a bonus across the Anacostia River and out of Washington, D.C. And the moral of the story is that we have this idea in this country that everybody supports the troops, and everybody does. But our country does not work, our government does not work on goodwill. It works on the basis of organization. It works on the basis of collective power. The NRA is powerful because they have a lot of members and they're very active. Ditto for the Sierra Club, big labor, big business. All of these people work together, make campaign contributions, lobby on Capitol Hill. And veterans have yet to assert themselves in that way in this generation. And in terms of President Obama, I think that he had a very good record in the United States Senate. He was very critical of many of the disgraceful policies of the Bush administration relating to the treatment of our veterans. But, you know, a lot of other presidents have talked a good game before they got into office and then betrayed our wounded soldiers. And so I think it's really up to us to make sure that President Obama follows through on many of his promises.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's the number for people who are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. Toll-free 800-222-9455. When soldiers come home from Iraq or Afghanistan, and I'm talking about people who don't have visible, obvious injuries, is there any kind of screening or exams? Does the military just give people a once-over, check them out, just to make sure that there isn't anything that maybe might not be readily apparent, or maybe even that person is not, for whatever reason, doesn't want to talk about?
Well, what they do is they're required by federal law to do a post-deployment screening. That's what it's called. Mm-hmm. When people come home, they're supposed to give them a once-over. But the way that the military has been interpreting this law under President Bush, and it has yet to change under President Obama, is they have everyone fill out a form, and it's a checklist. And if they check the right box, then they get to see a doctor. But they don't. It's not like they get to see a doctor by themselves. They get into a big room where people under are tremendous peer pressure to admit that there's nothing wrong so they can be sent out again and be there for their buddies in the long term. And in many cases, even if they answer yes, that they are having problems with this questionnaire, they still don't get the help that they need. So one of the stories I tell in the book is of Brian Jason Rand of North Carolina, who was stationed at Fort Campbell in Kentucky, and he answered yes to all of these questions. Yes, I'm having nightmares. Yes, I can't sleep at night. Yes, I started drinking. All the signs pointed to post-traumatic stress disorder. And instead of giving him the medical care that he needed, the military ordered him deployed again to Iraq. And as a result of the strain, and as a result of the fact that he was having difficulty coping to begin with and then was being asked to go back to the site of his trauma, Brian killed himself, and he shot himself under the Cumberland River Pavilion in Clarksville, Tennessee, with a shotgun overnight one night. And his death, like so many of the other suicides of Iraq War soldiers and veterans, was 100% preventable by our government if they only did what they're obligated by law to do.
Something, I mean, among all of these things that are disturbing, something else that is really disturbing is that there seem to be some cases, and you can give some examples, talk about how much, cases when soldiers clearly seem to be having emotional, psychological problems, and the military says, well, this problem is your problem. You had this problem when you joined. It wasn't as a result of your service. It was something that you brought into the military with you. So that being the case, then we in the military say, well, this is not our problem. This is your problem.
No, we've had tens of thousands of people discharged for personality disorder. So you come back from your tour in Iraq. You don't have post-traumatic stress disorder because you've just been in a war and maybe killed people, maybe seen your buddies be killed. You're not having trouble because you've been on hand while there's been a number of roadside bomb explosions, and you're not having trouble coping for those reasons. No, you were crazy when you joined up, and we just discovered it now. And so as a result of these personality disorder discharges, we have tens of thousands of people who have been kicked out of the military with no benefits whatsoever. And in addition to that, we have thousands of combat veterans who come home and they start to smoke pot or they start to drink too much to cope, and they either did or didn't try to get into that medical care system. But once they fail the urine test, they get kicked out with a dishonorable discharge and they get no benefits. And I talk in my book about Staff Sergeant Don Hanks of Tacoma, Washington, who came back to Fort Lewis after his tour in Iraq. He had been in the Army for 14 years, had an excellent service record. But after his tour in Iraq, and he saw many of his friends get killed, and he had tremendous survivor guilt. You know, how is it that I was able to survive? Why am I better than my friends who died? And he started to smoke pot to dull the pain, and so the Army got rid of him. Dishonorable discharge. So when I talked to him, this about 2 years ago, he was trying to muddle away. He was working as a window washer in Seattle skyscrapers. He liked being up high away from everyone else, all by himself washing the windows. But he really did need some help, but the government wasn't there for him.
We have some other callers. We'll get to them in just a moment. I do want to introduce once again our guest, independent journalist Aaron Glantz. Some people, I think, will know him for having written about Iraq and the Iraq War. His work has appeared in a number of places, including The Nation, The Progressive, Democracy Now! His most recent book deals with a subject we're talking about this morning, and that is the experiences of wounded vets who come home from Iraq and Afghanistan, the problems they have in getting help, and often how inadequate that help is. The title of his book is The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, and it's published by the University of California Press. We have several people here who want to get in on the conversation. We just, again, we welcome callers. Just ask people to try to be brief so we can get in as many as possible, but anyone's welcome to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next caller up here, I believe, is Pontiac, and that would be line 4, a toll-free line. Hello.
Hi, my name is Dr. Nancy Murbitz, and I'm a psychologist with a pretty extensive background in traumatic brain injury rehab and 2 years' experience in training in a VA medical center. And I am wondering, what is the status of following recommendations that were made by Tammy Duckworth and others to make the assistance of private practitioners or practitioners in non-VA settings available to veterans, particularly those in rural areas? And let me complete this. In Pontiac, there is a VA health center, a very small one. Veterans with medical and mental health needs are given transportation up to Hines VA, which is 2 hours from here, and particularly for mental health things, which usually somebody would be followed weekly for some period of time. That seems, you know, incompatible with employment and very inconvenient. So I've actually called up there to find out, is there any process by which I could provide follow-up mental health care for the veterans and assist in traumatic brain injury reintegration in the community afterwards? And I'm meeting with a dead end, but when I research it, there have actually been many high-level people make that recommendation to the VA. So the question
is, you make an excellent point. I mean, this war is being disproportionately fought by people in rural communities.
Yep.
You know, we never had a war that was this long with an all-volunteer force before, and it just so happens that people in rural America are more likely to join the Army and more likely to fight in this war.
Mm-hmm.
And the VA is heavily invested in the cities, and that's a fact. I was interviewing a guy out in California in Stockton, and he was trying to go to community college and get his degree. He was trying to get his medical care at the same time for both his post-traumatic stress disorder and his traumatic brain injury. And he was having to go 1 day a week to Sacramento, which is an hour and a half to the north, to get his PTSD treatment. And then he was having to go 2 days a week to Stanford, which is 2 hours to the south and the west, to get his traumatic brain injury treatment. And so he got expelled from school for missing his classes because he was always on these VA shuttle vans going to get medical care that was so far away.
Right. And there are practitioners who have experience, like myself, and I don't think I'm that rare, have experience with PTSD and traumatic brain injury. You'd think I'd be good as gold, but...
Well, you know, I don't know what the status of what Tammy Duckworth was trying to do in the state of Illinois, but I can say that nationally there was an effort to get this kind of outreach into the stimulus bill that President Obama just signed, and the Republicans took it out. The Republicans you mentioned, you may remember, were saying we shouldn't put things in the stimulus bill that have nothing to do with stimulating the economy.
Yeah, right.
And so they thought this expansion of the VA services into rural areas did not do enough to stimulate the economy, and it was eliminated from the bill that President Obama signed for that reason.
Well, I know Duckworth and others testified to Congress back, you know, federal Congress in 2007, and Tammy Duckworth was one of those, gave extensive, detailed testimony about the need for community integration for vets, and this not only rural, but the VA in general in any location does not have community integration programs, you know, sort of post-acute rehabilitation programs. So she said, we will never catch up with this in time to help these veterans, and we must reach out to private settings to provide
Yeah, well,
them.
You know, one thing is we are not doing enough to meet veterans where they are at.
You're right.
You know, I was talking earlier about my friend James Eggemeyer, who came home to Stuart, Florida, and you know as well as I do that when you come home to get into that VA system, you have to fill out a 26-page form, where you have to document everything and anything that you think is wrong with you. And you have to, if you think you have PTSD, you have to explain the traumatic incident that traumatized you just to get in the door. If you think you have TBI, you have to document the concussions that you were in. And, you know, people need to get in the door so they can begin to talk about these things. We shouldn't make it a prerequisite for getting that care.
People in the general public don't understand those things. Why would you know, somebody experiencing them really understand them in a sophisticated way right off the bat? They wouldn't.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things that we could be doing that we did actually do after Vietnam was do tremendous outreach in terms of setting up community clinics in places like our community colleges where veterans mm-hmm. go after they return home from war. You know, people sign up for the military often to go to college, and the first place they go when they come back is their community college to brush up their skills before they transfer to whatever four-year degree they eventually want to get.
Mm-hmm.
And they're there at every community college in this country, hundreds of veterans.
Oh, sure.
And there's no, I mean, just think about what it would do if we had in this country at each and every one of these community colleges, which have hundreds of Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans, a lounge with a couple couches and a coffee maker and somebody who came by and just made office hours a few days a week.
You're giving me an idea for our community college. You're giving me an idea for what I might do at our community college. My last question, I don't know if it's appropriate for this show, but the folks at Hines did say if a veteran made the request to see me that that could be processed, but they couldn't set up anything for veterans to know that I was
available.
No,
that's exactly the whole problem. This is why the book is called The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. We put the entire burden of everything on the veteran's shoulder. We say, you're a wounded veteran. You're just back from Iraq. You have physical brain damage. That's what traumatic brain injury is. You have physical brain damage. And we ask you to advocate for yourself, to fill out all this paperwork if you want to see a doctor, instead of saying, you know, this doctor is available. Go see them if you want.
I want to thank the caller very much for her comments. We're moving into our last 15 minutes, and I have some other people I want to include. Just to underline this point, it sounds as if we have a major problem here in that, and this is probably true for vets no matter where they live, but particularly for rural areas, but perhaps no matter where they live, it's simply that the system as it exists is nowhere near what it needs to be to serve the need. That is, that the need is so much greater than the system that exists to address it.
Well, we haven't had the opportunity to talk yet about all the ways that President Bush betrayed us, and maybe now is a good opportunity, because we are now living with the impacts of those decisions, and it's up to President Obama to solve these problems. When George Bush started the war in Iraq, people came to him and told him, Mr. President, you are starting a war. There will be casualties. There's no war without casualties. You need to hire more doctors at the VA. You need to hire more psychologists and claims adjusters. And those people who stood up and made this very sensible request were fired. So Anthony Principi, the first director of the VA under President Bush, when he started the war, he said, we need to hire more doctors. He was fired. Jim Nicholson was brought in. to head the VA, former real estate developer from Colorado, former head of the Republican National Committee who helped George Bush in the recount effort in the year 2000, no particular experience running a large bureaucracy or a healthcare institution like the VA, but could be counted on to toe the government line. Dr. Francis Murphy, hired by the VA to do a mental health assessment of what the VA should be doing. She found that mental health care was so inaccessible as to be worthless. She was fired. Who gets promoted? Dr. Ira Katz, the head of mental health care at VA under President Bush, when CBS News started to do an investigation into the shocking number of veteran suicides, wrote an email to their spokesperson, telling their spokesperson not to tell CBS what the VA already knew about the problem. And the email said, shh, S-H-H exclamation point, don't tell CBS News that 1,000 veterans under our care attempt suicide every month. We have to find a way to spin this. So for the last 6 years of war, when we've had war in Iraq, and 8 years of war in Afghanistan, when the Bush administration could have been preparing to treat the wounded, they were trying to sweep our wounded soldiers under the rug instead. And now that Barack Obama is the president, he's got a lot to do in terms of making up for lost time.
Yeah. Well, let's go on to some other callers here. Next in line, we have somebody in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. My question is basically, what are some of the obstacles in the way of reforming this system? I mean, it seems as though there would be the political will to do this. Is it simply that there isn't a lobbying effort like there is for, as you mentioned, the Sierra Club or the NRA, or is it something deeper than that? And I'll just listen on the air.
Thank you.
No, I think it's an excellent question. We have to ask ourselves, why does this happen generation after generation? I think the VA bureaucracy has become very entrenched over time, like any bureaucracy. It has been set up in this really hostile fashion by our politicians to keep veterans from accessing the health care because right now, you know, as I mentioned, you have to fill out this 26-page form just to get into the system. You have to get all your military documents together. You have to convince bureaucrats that you really deserve the care. Well, a lot of veterans just give up, and that saves the government a lot of money because the government doesn't have to pay to take care of them if they give up and they say, screw it, I'm not even going to battle this anymore. I think that one of the things that would really help us is if we had some honesty, you know, from our politicians about the true cost of the war and what we are facing. I mean, all of the statistics that we've been giving out this hour were things that I had to gather up through my own investigative journalism. I had to use the Freedom of Information Act. I had to threaten to file lawsuits against the government because the government was unwilling to even talk about how many casualties there were from this war. One of the things that I hope President Obama will do is usher in a new era of honesty. You know, he or his VA secretary, Eric Shinseki, could hold a press conference every month where they give us these statistics as a matter of course, just like the way the Pentagon tells us how many soldiers have been killed in battle. And I think that that would be really helpful in terms of building a public consciousness that supports a more friendly attitude to our veterans.
Well, let's go to Montgomery. This is line number three for another caller. Hello.
Good morning. This is a sad state of affairs for our country. I think it's just disgraceful that we have to you have to talk about stuff like this. You know, to me, this is a good enough reason not to even have war. Period. I mean, I just heard something on the news earlier today that they're sending 17,000 more troops over to Afghanistan.
Yes,
and
that's right.
For what? For what? So they could get legs and arms blown off and have the same kind of crap come back to us? This is not the United States of America, as far as I'm concerned. It's like a, I want to say like a puppy mill, only a human mill. You know, to send guinea pigs out there to whatever they feel like. You know, it kind of makes me angry at ourselves for voting these idiots in every time an election comes up.
Well, I think that one of the things that we have to demand is that, you know, you could agree or disagree with this deployment to Afghanistan. I also disagree with it. But regardless of how you feel, the cost of what's going to happen to these 17,000 men and women after they come home has to be factored in on the front end when we send them into battle.
I agree with you.
We can't. I mean, why are we surprised every time when wounded people come home from war? Has there ever been a war where nobody got hurt?
See, you know, I'm a product of the 60s, the 50s, and the 60s. So I watched a lot of my friends go into battle and come home, you know, and not one of them ever came home the same way they left. Every one of them has changed. All right? And this is what frustrates me, is because the government knew this going in. They knew about the Vietnam War, yet they didn't change it. And it isn't a Republican in office. I'm an ex-Republican, and this is one of the reasons why I'm not a Republican anymore, because they're spineless. And it's not just them, it's both the Democrats. The Democrats had a chance to stop this war, eight
Democrats
years ago.
The Democrats have an opportunity right now to do
exactly.
something about taking care of our veterans after they come home from this war, and we are still waiting on them to deliver as we speak.
Again, I'm going to jump in here, and I hope the caller will forgive me. I appreciate his comments, as we're really getting short on time, and I want to get some other people. But, this gets at a question that I really wanted to raise, and I think we've, in a variety of ways, we've touched on, and that is, you know, in the time that we've been in Iraq, there's been a lot of talk about changing attitudes toward the military, or perhaps not toward the military, but toward the soldier, and how those have changed since Vietnam, and how people now are saying, as you have said, you know, you can agree or disagree with the mission, but what we're going to do is honor the commitment of the people that decide to go. Having said all that, though, if you look at how poorly we are addressing the needs of the returning veterans, you wonder, well, just how much attitudes have changed.
Well, I mean, I think the issue is a lack of public attention. I appreciate you having me on your show today so that we could discuss it. And as you can see from your number of callers and the outrage that they feel, people do care and people are interested, but they aren't being heard. And many people are disengaged. You know, when I'm on my book tour, when I get in my car driving in from the airport to whatever city, I'm much more likely to hear about the octuplet mom in Southern California or the latest shenanigans with Britney Spears than I am about the treatment of our wounded veterans. And that's why these problems continue. I think purely an issue of public attention. I was at this forum in Washington, D.C. Ken Burns was screening his excellent documentary series, The War, that was on PBS about World War II. And afterwards, he had a panel discussion. And on the panel, there were three veterans, a World War II veteran, a Vietnam vet, and a Iraq War veteran who had been an interrogator at Abu Ghraib. And the World War II veteran said, when I came home, they welcomed me with open arms. And the Vietnam vet said, when I came back, they spit on me. And the Iraq War veteran said, when I came back, nobody cared. Nobody was interested in listening to my story. And that's why I decided to write the book, because I wanted to make sure that I was doing my part to give voice to these stories.
Yeah. Well, 5 minutes left here. Our guest is independent journalist Aaron Glantz. His book is The War Comes Home. We have another caller here that I want to get to, someone in St. Joe. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the federal employees that work at the VA.
Yes.
You know, they are good people that want to provide a good service. However, their budgets have been cut, and rather than expanding the number of people within their department, you know, they've had to continuously try to save money. And, you know, they need to be expanding the number of people that are the government employees working for the VA. They have special training working for veterans, and they're very committed to working for
absolutely
veterans. And they hate the fact that they're in a situation where they have to see people so quickly and they can't spend the time they want. And especially over the last 8 years, there was a real push to try to get them to push these the veterans out to be seen by the private sector.
Well, I think that I really appreciate you making that comment, and we often don't talk enough about the dedication of our VA doctors and nurses, and also the special expertise that they have in treating people who are back from war. And I think this gets at the way that we budget for our veterans. You know, think about the way that we budget for Social Security. That's an entitlement, right? You pay into Social Security. When you retire, you are due a certain amount of money. We don't say to people when they retire, oh, I'm sorry, we only have $100 to split across everyone in this country, so you only get 18 cents of your retirement. But that's the way we budget for our veterans. It doesn't matter, you know, they budget for how many doctors we hire independent of how many patients there are. And what we need is we need the VA to give an honest assessment to President Obama of how many doctors would actually be required to treat the number of veterans returning home to Iraq from Iraq and Afghanistan adequately, as well as our Vietnam and Gulf War and Korean and World War II veterans who aren't getting any younger. And then we need President Obama to look it over and agree that he is also committed to that, providing that quality of care.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. It's just been unfortunate. It seems like they've been running down the VA to try to demonize government employees so they can justify, doing away with government services and just getting everything to the private sector. But thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We have a couple of minutes left. You know, something that maybe you might talk a little bit about, and this is aside from the problem with providing health care services to veterans, is other kinds of veterans benefits. And I ask the question because I think a lot of people would make the comment that part of the post-war boom here in the United States was due to the GI Bill and the opportunity that it gave a lot of returning soldiers to go to college and to become educated and go out and get good jobs and help to fuel the economy. And I think that another one of the things that people have really pointed to as a place that we've fallen down is that the benefits, those kinds of benefits that are provided to returning service people are much, much less, disappointingly small when compared with the kinds of benefits that, for example, the guys who fought in World War II got when they came back.
Well, the good news is that the one victory, the one big, big victory that we've won in terms of the treatment of our veterans since this war began is to get a good GI Bill passed through the House and Senate and signed by President Bush. He didn't want to sign it. John McCain was also against it, but they attached it to the war spending, and they said this is a cost of war to give people good education benefits when they come home. And so starting in the fall, this coming fall, August 2009, a new GI Bill will be launched that will actually pay college tuition and a living stipend for veterans to go to any public college or university in their state. It's a tremendous victory. But we need to look at that in combination with the medical care that we're providing. Because if you're coming back and you have post-traumatic stress disorder or you have a traumatic brain injury, if you have memory loss, if you have constant migraines, if you can't sleep at night and are drinking to cope, you're not going to succeed at college no matter how good the GI Bill benefit is. You need to recover physically and emotionally so that you can succeed at school. And so all of these things need to work in tandem. So I'm really happy about the new GI Bill. Mm-hmm. I'm really happy that I think it marked the beginning of our country waking up to the need that we need to support our veterans after this war. But it's not enough. We need more.
We talked a little bit earlier, way back at the beginning, about the numbers of soldiers, hundreds of thousands who filed disability claims and the big backlog there, and hundreds of thousands who are looking for medical care from the VA. These numbers now today are very big. Is the expectation truly, when people look at this and recognize the possibility that people could, that the results of injuries could really manifest later?
Oh,
are we
absolutely
expecting these numbers really to go up?
We are. We are indeed expecting these numbers to go up. And remember, David, that this war is not over. So we are expecting these numbers to go up also because the number of veterans continues to increase.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Barack Obama just announced he's sending 17,000 more troops to Afghanistan. He has not yet announced any reduction in the number of troops being sent to Iraq, which means our total number of veterans is going to be rising at a faster rate than it was at President Bush's tenure. And we have no reason to expect that the propensity of people to get hurt is going to be any different. And that's why, you know, every day that we don't solve this problem is not only one, maybe two, 3 days that we've lost. Because, you know, these problems can compound on each other. You know, if somebody comes home and they need care for their post-traumatic stress disorder and they get it, and then they begin to recover, and then they use their GI Bill benefit, and they get a degree from college, and they get a good job, and they own a home, and are married, and, you know, are stable, then they're contributing to our society. But if people come home again, and they get turned away from those services, and they begin to abuse drugs or alcohol, and they fall through the cracks, and end up homeless on the street, as we have 200,000 veterans sleeping homeless on the street every night from all of our wars, many of them Vietnam, veterans, with one out of every three homeless men in America being a U.S. military veteran, then they become a drain on the system instead. And so now is the time when all of these people are coming home that we can repeat, we can either repeat the disgrace that happened after Vietnam, or you know, we can write a different story this time around.
Well, there we will have to finish up. We've come here to the end of the time. If you'd like to read more on the subject, the book to look for, the one we've been talking about, the title is The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. It's published by the University of California Press by our guest, independent journalist Aaron Glantz. He is also the author of the book How America Lost Iraq, and his work has appeared in a number of places, including The Nation and The Progressive and Democracy Now. And Aaron Glantz, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you.